Okay, so we're continuing our discussion of Shaka Okumura's Living by Vow text. We are on to chapter 8, the sutra opening verse. So in keeping with our practice that we've had during this study series, and just to kind of put everything in perspective here. So we're on to chapter 8, with sutra opening. Next week, I will do a deep dive into our ancestral lineage chant that we do on Sundays. It's not covered in the Okumura book because it couldn't be, because it's unique to our tradition, or at least parts of it are unique to our tradition. But I'll be here to do that. And then the 29th, we'll conclude this particular study series with Domyo spinning back around to chapter 7 of the Okumura text. So then we'll be done with the specific study series. Should be great. So in keeping with how we've been doing things, the sutra opening verse is found on page 3 of the chant book. And I'm sorry, I was meaning to have the link to the chant book. John, do you have that readily available that you could put in the Zoom chat for those in the cloud? If it's not already there, I don't know. It might already be there from earlier, but. There it is. Okay. So for those of you in the cloud, there's a link in the Zoom chat now to the chant book. This is on the physical chant book, page 3, or on the PDF version, it's page 7. So, and it's the second verse, or the second chant, sutra opening verse, the Kaikyoge. So let's go ahead and chant this together. Here we go. The unsurpassed, profound, and wondrous Dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, accept and maintain it. May we unfold the meaning of the Tathagata's truth. Thank you. So, a little bit about this verse. I think some of us may not be familiar with this particular verse because it has not historically been a part of the Bright Way Zen liturgy. And there's two reasons for that. The primary one is that Domyo was raised, if you will, in the Dharma Rain tradition, where in their regular practice at Sesshin and their Zazenkai and their and whatnot, they don't do this. At Sesshin and Zazenkai in particular, they use the Teisho model, where during a period of Zazen, the teacher offers words of encouragement, or Teisho. It's not really a Dharma talk per se, but it's kind of like a mini Dharma talk light, if you will. And so since that's the tradition that she grew up with, that's how we do things here too. The other reason why we do not historically do it is because, and this is coming directly from Domyo herself, the verse seems a little too grandiose. You know, it's a little much. I mean, you look at it, it's like this wondrous, profound Dharma. She's like, you know, and then she's like, and then it's just me talking. So, okay, you know. And I'll talk a little bit later about, you know, how that actually does work. But this is not universal to all Zen centers. There are Zen centers in the country and probably elsewhere that do it as a regular thing. I was first exposed to it through Ocean Gate Zen Center in Northern California. They do it just before their regular Sunday Dharma talks. And I've heard other Zen centers do the same. So that's probably why it's not familiar to us here. However, that's all changed in recent history. Those of you who participated in our April Sesshin or in our June Zazenkai actually have chanted this. And that's because Domyo decided to add it into our liturgy during Sesshin and Zazenkai. She's still not going to do it before a Sunday talk because it's too casual and kind of you know, everybody's just getting together and just having a discussion and listening to Domyo, and it's pretty cool. But the formality and the structure of Sesshin and Zazen Kai definitely lends itself more to this type of verse. So we've now done it at exactly five times. We can count on one hand, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday of Sesshin, and the Saturday Zazen Kai in June. So if you don't know anything about this, you're not familiar with it, it's because you did not go to Sesshin or Zazen Kai. But if you do go to Sesshin or Zazen Kai, you will do this now with Brightway Zen. And the reason that she introduced it now is because this is a part, it's not a part of Dharma Rain's liturgy, but it is a part of Great Vow Zen Monasteries and Heart of Wisdom's liturgy. And she's been practicing at Great Vow for many years. She's now recently been studying directly with Hogan Bay's Roshi up there at Great Vow Zen Monastery. And so she thought, let's add that piece of their liturgy in. We already have various pieces of our liturgy that come from Great Vow and aren't done at Dharma Rain. We just don't know it necessarily. But this is now a new addition for us. So it's kind of cool. So the way that we do it at Sesshin, for those of you who were not able to participate in either of those retreats, we chant this verse just like we just did it. Very slow, very reverentially. And then Domyo does a Dharma talk. And probably like, 20, 25 minutes, something like that, I think. I can't remember how long. But and then we chant the four Bodhisattva vows at the end, which we talked about during when we studied chapter one of the Okamura text. So it all comes together. But that's another one that we haven't normally done in anywhere except in the Saturday just sitting. So it's kind of cool to have that the Bodhisattva vows introduced into the liturgy of Sesshin and Zazen Kai as well. So, yeah. So what is the sutra opening verse? Well, as I've said, it's used to open up a Dharma talk. And so if you look at the Okamura text, or if you've already read it, I'm not actually going to focus very much on this book, but there's just one part I want to talk about. So Okamura in the text, he spends the first two pages kind of delving into the Japanese words themselves and talking about what they mean. Of course, Japanese words have much deeper meaning than what we might think at first glance. It's what, the 1, 2, 3rd paragraph down on page 250, if you've got the book in front of you, but I'll read it anyway. The expression jin jin min, The expression jin jin minyo no ho is from the Lotus Sutra, one of the most important sources of Dogen Zenji's teachings. For Dogen Zenji, the Lotus Sutra was essential because it describes the Mahayana way of the Bodhisattva. The expression most profound, subtle, and wondrous Dharma, of course, his translation is a little different than ours, is from the second chapter titled Expedient Devices. So I actually want to spend the rest of our time tonight not talking about this book, because you can read it yourself, but instead talking more about the Lotus Sutra and the origins of this sutra opening verse, where it comes from, what it means, why it's important, and all of that. So the translation I have here, the Threefold Lotus Sutra, is by Michio Shinozaki, Brick Zipperin, and David Earhart. It's a relatively new translation, and it's been reworded to be a little more accessible to modern readers. I really appreciate this translation more than others that I've read. Other translations I've read, I was like, whoa, after a couple of pages, I'm just like, dude, that's a lot. So this one's pretty accessible. And so I'm going to just pull out a couple of passages from chapter 2 of the Lotus Sutra and talk a little bit more about that. Actually, let me do that in just a moment. Let me just give you a little context for the Lotus Sutra in general first. Let's do that first. So the Lotus Sutra is of somewhat unknown provenance. It probably originated in the first couple centuries of the Common Era, you know, good, 500-600 years or so after the historical Buddha went into Parinirvana, passed away. It's of unknown authorship too. We're not really sure who wrote it, but it was most likely some Indian Buddhist scholars who put this together. And of course, there's a whole lot of very intense scholarly research that's gone into figuring out when it was written, who wrote it. And they were able to glean at least that much, mostly from later texts that came along that referenced the Lotus Sutra. and said, well, this text by, you know, Vasubandhu or by Nagarjuna references the Lotus Sutra, and that was written in the 3rd century, so it must have come before that. So they're, you know, they're kind of able to extrapolate from all of that. And with the language and some the way the terminology is used, they're able to figure out kind of the Indian roots of it. But the Lotus Sutra was, you say, well, why did these Indian Buddhist scholars, hundreds of years after the Buddha's Parinirvana, why did they choose to put this out in the world? Now, of course, the idea that a handful of Buddhist scholars put this whole thing together kind of depends on your love for mythology and superstition. Some would say no, it didn't come from a bunch of Indian scholars. All these Mahayana sutras were, the Buddha gave them to the Naga king, the serpent, sea serpent in the bottom of the lake, and said, here, hold on to these until humans are ready for it, because they're not ready right now. And then in the 3rd century, Nagarjuna came and went down to the Naga realm and retrieved them. And, you know, so, you know, one of my favorite sayings is, with all these mythological tales of, you know, in Buddhism, the cosmological aspects of it, is that it's true whether it happened or not. You know, because the truth of it doesn't lie in the actual historical events, but in the message behind them. So why would the Lotus Sutra even come about all these hundreds of years after the Buddha passed into Parinirvana? The primary focus for this text, and thank you, in the chat, there's a request for some of the bibliographical information. I'll give that to you a little later on. The primary reason why the Lotus Sutra existed was to promote Mahayana ideals. And Shohaku Okamura hints at this on page 250 of his text. They really wanted to get the Mahayana ideas across. And the best way to do that was to put these ideas into the context of the actual Buddha appearing before a vast number of people and saying, here's this Dharma, right? And giving it to us. And, you know, putting it in the context of this, the Buddha said these things, whether he actually said them or not, he probably didn't. But the idea was, because up until that point, you know, first couple centuries of the Common Era, Buddhism during the Buddha's time, when it wasn't called Buddhism at all, obviously, but during the Buddha's time, and then for the hundreds of years afterwards, as the early Buddhist, his teachings, the suttas, as they became known, were being handed down through an oral tradition. They didn't actually get written down for hundreds and hundreds of years. They were finally written down many years later. So this very, very accurate oral tradition developed in the early Buddhist Sangha to pass these teachings down, and, you know, different monks would memorize this scripture and other monks would memorize this scripture, and then all this teaching would propagate. The primary practice of that style of Buddhism, what in the Lotus Sutra is referred to as Hinayana, which means lesser vehicle, and Mahayana meaning greater vehicle. Sounds like there's a little bit of judgment in there, right? Well, ours is greater and yours is lesser. And some have used it in that context, use those terms in that way. But I think there's more, in the Lotus Sutra kind of gets into this, there's more of this idea of the Hinayana way, quote unquote, the way that the early Buddhist Sangha practiced for hundreds of years after the Buddha's death as well. It's not wrong. It's not invalid. We're not trying to replace it. We're trying to enhance it. We're trying to go above and beyond these teachings. So what were these teachings? Well, the idea in early Buddhism was that you, number one, it was almost a requirement that you ordain. Lay followers could practice the Buddha Dharma, but you could never, never even come close to attaining anything near enlightenment in that state, in the dusty world, you know, of the home life. So you had to ordain. And when you ordained, you had to give up everything. All of your possessions, all of your money, all of your relationships. You had to be celibate. You couldn't handle money. You couldn't cultivate your own food or store your own food. You had to always accept alms from followers, you know, and the only possessions you had were your robes and your begging bowl. And that was it, right? And so the closest corollary to that in our modern day is what we would call the Theravada tradition, the Thai forest traditions, various Thai forest traditions. Where monastics do exactly this. They ordain, they give up everything, they shave their head, they don the ochre robes, as the early Pali Canon says, and they go forth into the homeless life, you know, from the dusty home life. And The idea behind that practice is to what they call it throughout the Pali Canon, they refer to it as uprooting the fetters. Uproot the fetters, which basically means to dig out all your bad karma and get rid of it. Right. And so the idea was you can't do that. You can't fully dispel your greed, anger, and ignorance if you're at home and you're like surrounded by it all the time. You just can't do it. Right. So you got to ordain, you got to go off and you got to practice with the Sangha, and you kind of have to limit your interactions with the general public to your begging routes. You go into town once a day for alms, you get your begging bowl, and then you go off in the forest and you eat, and then you just meditate there. And like, that's it. Right. And so this tradition cultivated a very strong respect for isolation. It's highly valued in that tradition to go off to a hermitage and not talk to people necessarily, you know, not so much now, but, you know, this idea of going off to the root of a tree, as the Pali Canon says, or into a forest or to an abandoned hut or to the mouth of a cave. And there's all this language in the Pali Canon that just goes, you know, repeats all these things over and over again. This was the ideal. And so there's this aspect of that can seem to be somewhat selfish, that I am practicing for myself. I am practicing for my own enlightenment and nobody else really. Now, of course, there's the idea that, well, by practicing for full enlightenment and attaining full enlightenment, I am showing compassion to all living beings, but it was a little more indirect, right? And so the goal of early Buddhism was the attainment of nibbana in the Pali tongue, or nirvana in the Sanskrit, which literally means extinguishment. So it's like literally you're like putting out the flame of a candle, right? And so the metaphor here is that the candle, the fire, is the fire of what is the fire of woe and the flames of troubling passion, as it says in the precious mirror samadhi, right? That the greed and anger and ignorance and samsara and dukkha and all of this is its flames and it's burning us constantly, you know? And the only way to put out that fire is to achieve full enlightenment, full nirvana, and become fully unbound, as the Pali Canon refers to it. And so uprooting the fetters as a shackle, and then becoming fully unbound. So you're breaking those shackles. So in practical terms, what this meant was, and they've got multiple levels. So like you're a practitioner and you can achieve, first is the level of the sotapanna, or the stream enterer, which means that, okay, I'm a stream enterer now, which means that all my successive lives that happen after this one, I will never backslide from the Buddhist teachings. I will always practice Buddhism in some form. Or you're a twice returner, which means I have achieved a level of ability with the Dharma that I'm guaranteed to only have two more lives after this one, and then I will achieve full nirvana. Or I'm a once returner, the next level up, or I have one more life, and then after that life, in that life, I will achieve full nirvana. And then the ones who were actually able to do it in this life, when they were practicing in the Buddhist Sangha, were called arhats, or arahants, as we see that term used quite a bit, even in the Mahayana teachings. And so what that means is when you attain enlightenment, when you attain full nirvana, nibbana, when you die, you're gone. There's no karma to propel you forward into the next life. You just kind of cease to be in any way, shape, or form, right? And so the Mahayana ideal, and some of you are already like, oh, I can see the big differences already, right? You know, the Mahayana ideal that they were really trying to propagate in the Lotus Sutra and some of the other Mahayana, early Mahayana texts, especially the Prajnaparamita Sutras that Nagarjuna helped to propagate in the 3rd century. It was really about saying, no, that's all good. Bless your little heart. That was great. You know, achieve full nirvana. What they call in the Mahayana text, the Shravaka path. But that's not the end of the story. You thought it was the end of the story, but it's not the end of the story. There's actually this great supreme awakening teaching that's superior to that. And that teaching says, no, you do not attain full nirvana for yourself. You purposely delay your own enlightenment so that you can keep being reborn life after life, so that you can help save all sentient beings. This is the first line of the Bodhisattva vow. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Well, you can only try to do that if you come back life after life after life and you continue. And you don't have to, like, I could achieve nirvana, but I'm not going to, because I have compassion for all sentient beings. I want to come back and I want to help them. So this is the Bodhisattva ideal that's very, very heavily propagated in all the Mahayana teachings. And so, of course, all of this is predicated on a belief in literal rebirth. But if you don't subscribe to that particular line of thinking, you can still apply the whole concept of rebirth and unbinding and all of these things to just your moment by moment existence. Every moment that I'm alive, I'm dying, I'm being reborn. Others are dying and being reborn in some way. There's just new things popping up all over the place. We're changing constantly. Impermanence, right? We're just, everything's always in a state of flux and flow. And so rebirth happens on a moment by moment basis. And so can we return to each moment and come back to save all sentient beings, right? So you can apply it on that much more practical down to earth scale, or you can apply it on a more cosmological scale. So the Mahayana sutras were basically trying to say, that's good and all, but that's not all of it. That's not enough. It's much more compassionate to return to the Saha world, return to the wheel of birth and death to help save all sentient beings. And then there are other elements of Mahayana thought that are not present in early Buddhism that are promoted throughout these Mahayana texts, such as the idea of Buddha nature, that we all have inherent Buddha nature. We all are essentially Buddhas. That's completely not present at all in early Buddhism. You do see no references to that in the Pali Canon, right? The only person who had Buddha nature was the Buddha, the ascetic Gotama, who lived 2,500 years ago. He was it, right? Until some other Buddha comes along and some other Kalpa, he was it, right? And so along with that, the idea that we are all Bodhisattvas as well. We are all baby Buddhas in training. Then we will all attain Buddhahood someday. Also completely absent from the early Buddhist teachings. And so the Mahayana, the people who were promoting it, the people who wrote the Lotus Sutra and wrote these other Mahayana sutras were really trying to get this idea across as being more relevant, more valuable than the Shravaka path, quote unquote. Not excluding the Shravaka path, not dismissing it, but just saying it's better. And so what you find in these Mahayana sutras, they all are set up somewhat the same. It's somewhat the same. There's the Buddha. He's present and he's usually happening in some like cosmic plane of existence. And there's like millions upon millions of Bodhisattvas and Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas and lay followers and everybody, like literally all creation is there listening to the Buddha, who's usually like floating in the sky or in some massive stupa or something. It's really cool. And there's like robes raining down and there's like musicians floating in air, playing heavenly music. It's all very, very cool. And so the Buddha is offering these teachings, or one of the Bodhisattvas is offering a teaching. And here comes Shariputra, who was one of the Buddha's chief disciples during his lifetime, was considered to be an arhat. He was a fully enlightened being. He followed the Buddha around for his 40 years of teaching. And he was there when the Buddha passed, and he went on and continued to teach after the Buddha passed into Parinirvana. So here comes Shariputra. And there's two examples that are really key. The Lotus Sutra itself, and then the Vimalakirti Sutra, which talks about one of the few lay followers who was actually able to achieve full enlightenment without ordaining, which Vimalakirti, who was like kind of this rich dude, like a merchant guy. But he was like super, super smart and super adept at the Dharma and all this kind of thing. And in the Vimalakirti Sutra, it's the same pattern. So here's Shariputra. And Shariputra kind of represents in these writings, he represents the literary device of the unwitting fool, if you will. So he's kind of the foil for all these ideas that are being presented. He's the one going over, wait, what? You know, he's kind of like, I don't understand what's happening here. You got to repeat this because I'm not sure I agree with this. And so he's really standing in for the Shravaka path. He's standing there as a representative of the teachings that we find in the Pali Canon that were being practiced during the early Buddhist Sangha during the Buddha's lifetime, he attained arhatship, right? And he was sure that this full unbinding, nirvana, that was it, man. That was the stuff. That was all that the Buddha had to offer, and I attained it. So why am I here? You know, and why is the Buddha here? Because he also was fully unbound. We should be like not here, right? And all of these events and these sutras take place. They're very clear that they take place after the Buddha passed into parinirvana, after Shariputra passed, you know. So they happened years after the, you know, or in some, you know, dimension of time that doesn't actually exist in real time. So here's Shariputra. And one of my favorite stories is actually in the Vimalakirti Sutra. So here he is. And it's well known that the early Buddhist Sangha's attitude towards ordained women was less than ideal, less than charitable. And Shariputra was one of the naysayers in that bunch. And so here he is in the Vimalakirti Sutra, and they're all standing in Vimalakirti's room, which is 10 feet by 10 feet, but somehow manages to hold like a million bodhisattvas and devas and all these. And here comes Avalokiteshvara, Kuan Yin, Kanon, Kanzayon, whatever name we want to call her by. The bodhisattva of compassion, the one who hears the cries of the world, right? And by this time in Buddhist history, she was being rendered as female instead of male. The early Buddhist Mahayana bodhisattva ideal had characterized her as a male. So kind of gender fluid in a lot of ways. So she shows up as a female. And here's Shariputra going, how can you be a great bodhisattva? You're just a woman. That's kind of the attitude he has, right? And Avalokiteshvara says, oh yeah, you think so? Well, watch this. And she switches bodies with it. And so now here's Shariputra in her body, and you know, she's in his. And she, basically, like, she's like, yeah, what do you think now, sucker? You know, how do you like it? Yeah. And he's all like, whoa, what's happening right now? You know, kind of flips out. So it's this, like, Shariputra always plays this role as the unwitting fool. He doesn't get treated very well in these Mahayana texts. He kind of gets he gets pawned on more than one occasion. And then we see him also show up in the Heart Sutra, one of the Prajnaparamita Sutras, which is much kinder to him, because all he basically does there is he's asking Avalokiteshvara for a teaching. And she says, okay, let's talk about emptiness. You know, form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. No eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, all the things that we chant. So he's kind of that unwitting fool, but he means well to a degree. You kind of can't fault him for his, like, you know, kind of bumbling around in the, you know, Shravaka path and all that. And so in the Lotus Sutra, he plays that same type of role. And it's a really interesting way for them to set up the Mahayana teaching. So I'd like to go ahead and give you a couple passages here. I don't want to get short on time, so I won't read too much. So this chapter is called Skillful Means. And I'll explain why they call it that. So it starts off, at that time, the world honored one, the Buddha, rising calmly from samadhi, addressed Shariputra. The wisdom of Buddhas is infinite and extremely profound. Recognize those words familiar? The approach to their wisdom is difficult to enter and difficult to understand. It is beyond the comprehension of even the Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas. He's basically saying, sorry, Shariputra, you're not going to get it, man. So then Shariputra's like, wait, what? What are you talking about? You got to be kidding me right now. And so the Buddha says, let me tell you about the great supreme awakening teaching. You ready? Here it goes. The Lotus Sutra is like one great big advertisement for the Lotus Sutra, but it never really gets around to telling you what the Lotus Sutra is. It's kind of interesting, yeah. So the Buddha's like, all right, I'm gonna expound this great supreme awakening teaching. At that time, there were 1,200 Shravakas in the Great Assembly who were undefiled arhats. They all wondered, for what reason does the world-honored one extol skillful means so intently and assert that the Dharma attained by the Buddha is so extremely profound and difficult? Why is the meaning of the words he speaks so difficult to grasp that not one of the Shravakas or Pratyeka Buddhas can do so? The Buddha taught us a single principle of emancipation, or nirvana. And moreover, we attained this teaching and reached nirvana. Now, however, we do not understand what he intended by teaching us this principle. So you had all these people who had followed his early teachings. It's happening right now. So then Shariputra's like, okay, he can tell. He's like, all right, all these Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas are like, we don't know what's happening right now. Shariputra says, Blessed One, please explain this profound Dharma to us. The Buddha says, enough, I should say no more. If I explain this matter, heavenly and human beings throughout the world would be astonished and perplexed. So then Shariputra asks again, please explain it, world-honored one. Please do explain it. The Buddha says again, that's enough, Shariputra. If I explain this matter, heavenly beings, humans, and asuras throughout the world would be astonished and perplexed, and prideful, arrogant monks might fall into a great pit. Shariputra asks again, a third time, please explain it, world-honored one. He's like, really, seriously, man, come on. Please explain it. In this present assembly, there are hundreds of thousands of millions of myriads like me who in former lifetimes have followed Buddhas and been transformed by them. Certainly, they can respect and believe it. The world-honored one then addressed Shariputra. Since you have earnestly made your request three times, how can I refuse? For your sake, I will now explain everything in full detail. And so this is the Buddha during his lifetime would never offer a teaching, just like walk up to somebody and say, hey, you want to hear about the Dharma? Yeah, he wasn't an evangelist in that sense. He waited. He would stay silent until he was asked three times. The first time, he'd either stay silent or he'd say, no, no. Second time, stay silent or say, no, no. Third time, okay. You really mean it. You really want me to explain, so I will. And so he does. And then he goes into this, basically the Mahayana teachings that I just explained, talking about Buddha nature and audio, just all sorts of really interesting Mahayana teachings, which again, I already kind of discussed. So then a really interesting thing happens. The Buddha is like, basically what he's been saying so far is, I know I taught you guys this thing when I was alive about becoming an arhat and full and binding nirvana and all that, but psych, that wasn't all there was to it. Sorry. You know. And so there's a degree to which he senses that I kind of need to explain why, you know? And so then the next chapter, chapter 3, he goes into the parable of the burning house. And which, of course, the synopsis of that, I'm sure everybody's familiar, but there's a father who's the Buddha, and he has all these children, which is us. And they're living in a ramshackle house, huge ramshackle house, which is samsara. It only has one exit, which is nirvana. And the house is burning because the world is burning, you know. And he's trying very hard to get us out. He's trying to convince us everything he could possibly do. Get out of the house. The house is on fire. And we're like, no, we're just playing with our toys, right? The children are playing with their toys. They're very fully engrossed in their toys, just like we are fully engrossed in greed, anger, and ignorance, expressing preference and anger and dismay and all of these things. And so the Buddha, and in the parable of the burning house, the father says, I know what to do. These children love deer carts and goat carts. I will promise them deer carts and goat carts if they go outside. So he says, hey, kids, guess what? You love deer carts and goat carts. Guess what's sitting outside? Deer carts and goat carts. Go see them. And all the kids are like, oh, sweet. Yeah. And they run out of the house. Now they're outside of the house. So the father's like, shoo, none of them are going to die in the burning house. But when the kids get outside, there are no deer carts or goat carts. But instead, what there are splendid gilded ox carts. And it's like, well, we didn't get what he promised us, but we got something better. And of course, that is a metaphor for this great supreme awakening teaching of the Mahayana, the Bodhisattva ideal, Buddha nature, all these things that we just talked about. And so in the parable of the burning house, at the end of it, he basically says, I'll give you the quotes. He says, Shariputra, I have just explained all these, they use skillful means. Oh, wait, that was I didn't flag you where. Okay, basically he says, Shariputra, was the father at any fault for lying to his kids, deceiving the children? And Shariputra is like, well, no, actually, because while he kind of deceived them that they were going to get deer carts and go-karts and they didn't get them, they got something better. So no, there was no deception there. And the Buddha says, such as it is here too, Shariputra, there was no fault in the Buddha teaching you this, the Shravaka path, teaching you this Dharma of nirvana, of uprooting the fetters, no fault, because that got you out of the burning house of samsara. But there's more. There's a better ox cart out there for you. And that's this great supreme awakening teaching of the Mahayana. So, kind of cool. So how does this relate to the sutra opening verse? Well, obviously, there's the text of the sutra opening verse comes from that first part of that chapter on skillful means. But it's really about, in the context of the Lotus Sutra, it's skillful means, meaning what teaching do you need to end your suffering? And it's different for everybody, right? And even there's in chapter 25 of the Lotus Sutra, it's a whole chapter about Avalokiteshvara, about Kanon. And it goes on for paragraphs about all the different forms that she can take to help relieve the suffering of sentient beings. If she needs to be a Buddha, she'll be a Buddha. If she needs to be a Pratyeka Buddha, she'll be a Pratyeka Buddha. If she needs to be a lay person, she'll be a lay person. If she needs to be a frog, she'll be a frog. You know, like whatever form she needs to take to help save sentient beings.
What's Pratyeka
Buddha? A Pratyeka Buddha, sorry, I guess I didn't define that. Pratyeka Buddha is someone who achieves full enlightenment and then just kind of keeps it to themselves. They never teach, they don't. So the Buddha himself, when Siddhartha Gautama achieved full awakening under the Bodhi tree, he had basically three choices. I've now attained full enlightenment. I could die. I could just like will myself to die right now and it'd be fine because I've achieved full unbinding. Or I could be a Pratyeka Buddha and just like keep it to myself and just like live in a cave for the rest of my life and not say anything to anyone. And he was entertaining those two. But then Brahmali, one of the Deva kings, appeared before him and said, no, I didn't say that. I forgot the name of the god. Anyway, one of the Deva god kings, whatever, appears and says, no, you must teach. Because, and the exact wording in the Pali Canon is, you must teach because there are beings in this world who have little dust in their eyes. Their vision is still clouded by greed, anger, and ignorance, but it can be brushed away by your teachings if you share this dharma with them. So that's Pratyeka Buddha. If the Buddha had just been like, cool, I've got enlightenment, I'm going off to a cave, then he would have been a Pratyeka Buddha. So this idea of skillful means, the Buddha was really good, and that's why there are so many suttas in the Pali Canon, because whatever this population, he would travel around and he'd go into this community and say, what's this community's problem? All right, let me offer a teaching that's going to help them end their suffering. And how those skillful means are used constantly by teachers, by the Buddha, and by ourselves to help end our suffering. So how this all relates back to the sutra opening verse, and why do we use it as a prelude to a Dharma talk? Well, it's not about the teacher, right? Dhammyo said, oh, it's this big grandiose thing, and then I'm going to just be like, hi, I'm going to give you. But it's not setting up the teacher as some elevated persona. The teacher is just the vessel for the Dharma. They're just the loudspeaker through which the Dharma is broadcast. Right? As we just chanted in the Genjo Koan about propelling the self forward to actualize the myriad things is delusion, but allowing the myriad things to work through the self is practice enlightenment, right? And so the teacher is just being a vessel for this practice enlightenment. And so what the verse is meant to do is to remind us that, hey, there's a person sitting there, the reason why we use it before a Dharma talk, there's a person sitting there and they're going to say some words, but remember what you're about to hear. Remember what this is all about. Remember why you are here. This is an incomparably profound and subtle Dharma. This Bodhisattva path, these Mahayana teachings on emptiness, on Buddha nature, all the things that we learn about in our Dharma study. It's absolutely monumental, this Dharma, right? As soon as you think you've got it, you've lost it, right? There's so many teachings that say that, right? It's infinite. It goes far beyond what any of us could ever try to fully encompass and explain. So keep that in mind. This is incomparably profound. And it's rarely met with, even in hundreds of millions, thousands of millions of kalpas. It doesn't come around that often. I mean, what's kalpa, right? I mean, mythologically, there's a couple of different metaphors, but the one that I like is, say there's a great mountain, and every 100 years, a hawk flies by the mountaintop with a feather in its talons and brushes against the top of the mountain every 100 years. A kalpa is the amount of time it would take to reduce the mountain to rubble. Whoa, dude, that's a long time, right? So even if we said like a kalpa is like the 15 billion years that this universe has been around, and however billion, many billion years it's going to be around, like that's some segment of a kalpa, an entire kalpa, like nobody knows what a kalpa is. But here we are, 2,500 years ago, Siddhartha Gautama sat under the Bodhi tree and achieved enlightenment, and then went out and taught. And that Dharma has been handed down from teacher to student for generations. And it's transformed, and it's gone into various cultures, and it's adapted to the culture that it entered, and it's changed, and it's been expanded on and developed, and it's this amazing, profoundly infinite and subtle Dharma. How lucky are we? How lucky are we that in all this time, all these kalpas, billions of people, whatever, we're here to hear this Dharma, to see this Dharma, to practice this Dharma. You're very lucky indeed. And so since we have it to hear and to see, let us understand it, because what a waste it would be if we didn't, right? What a waste it would be if we were like, here's this profoundly infinite, subtle Dharma, whatever. We'll go back to binging Netflix and eating ho-hos, you know, whatever. I mean, like, it would be really sad if we just pushed it aside and chose our delusion and our dukkha over this profound and infinitely subtle Dharma. What other spiritual tradition recommends the type of thing that we're practicing here? Most other, especially like deistic spiritual traditions, there's a little bit of an out. There's a saving grace. Like, even if you're a complete schlub, well, okay, you're at least going to be saved if you do these things, and you're going to go to heaven, and you'll be fine. You know? So you can kind of sit back and coast a little bit if you wanted to, you know. But in the Dharma, in the Buddha Dharma, there's no coasting, man. You gotta dig deep. You gotta work with that karma. You gotta sit that zazen. You gotta just figure out how to work with your greed, anger, and ignorance. You gotta learn how to deal with all of the frustrations and all of the negativity of the world, and find a way to find equanimity and peace and balance, and just manifest compassion. And it's a lot. So we are very blessed to have this infinitely profound Dharma to hear, to see, to practice. So it's kind of our responsibility, in a way, to penetrate the Tathagata's true meaning, to hear the Tathagata's words, and to practice the Tathagata's words. And so the sutra opening verse is kind of setting us up for that. Remember why you're here. Remember why you're here. You're not here to coast. You're not here to just hear some words and be like, yeah, that's cool, whatever. You are sitting in the middle of an infinitely profound Dharma that is rarely met with, millions of kalpas. Take advantage of it. Practice it. Hear it. See it. Feel it. So now that we maybe have a little more context for what this verse means, I'd like to chant it again, if you don't mind. So if you could pull up the chant book, page 3.
The unsurpassed, profound, and wondrous Dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, accept and maintain it. May we unfold the meaning of the Tathagata's through you.
Okay, thank you. We've got 7 minutes. So questions, comments, anyone? Yeah.
We need to sit up there again.
Yes.
What?
Yes.
Come on down. I feel like Bob Barker every time I say that. Come on down. You're the next contestant.
So the word Tathagata has stopped me every time I have read it. It's spelled a different way here than I've seen in scripture. And sometimes there is a line over some of the A's. And this is really bothering me. Please help.
Tathagata is a Pali Sanskrit term.
Okay.
And in Sanskrit in particular, TH is not pronounced th like it's we would with it's pronounced with the t.
Okay.
Yeah. So Tathagata.
Tathagata.
Tathagata. Yeah. What you really would do is there's a little bit of a hesitation between Tathagata. Tathagata.
Tathagata.
There's a little bit of an extra plosive. It's kind of subtle and hard.
But. Thank you. It is subtle, but you know, chanting it.
Yeah.
A lot easier now. So thank you very much.
Yeah. Tathagata. 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 It's got a cool rhythm to it, which means fully gone one. Thus gone. The one thus gone. Yeah. Gone, gone, completely gone. Right. Emily.
Hi, James. I just wanted to say thank you so much for this talk. I find your way of explaining things very engaging. And I was wondering if you could hold the book up again, just so I can make sure I found the right translation.
Yes, yes. So it's actually threefold Lotus Sutra. So there's more in here than just the main Lotus Sutra text. And it is, it's not going to focus on that. Look up Brooke Zipporyn, Zipporyn.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. And I say that because Brooke Zipporyn wrote the foreword to this, and it's really an interesting foreword. I was almost more like, once I read the foreword, I'm like, I could put the rest away. But because it's really fascinating because it kind of explains the context of Lotus Sutra and all that. So yeah, highly recommend it. A little more accessible than some of the other translations. Other questions or comments? Oh, thanks, Emily. She put it in the chat for those of you in the cloud if you want to pick it up. It's still dense, even with this modern translation, because the pattern that they have is like, there's, you know, the Buddha said this and Shariputra said this or whatever. And the Buddha said these things. And then wishing to make himself clear, he repeated himself in verse. And then it goes on for like seven pages of poetry of exactly the same thing that they just said in the previous paragraph. So it's a lot. Yeah. Other questions, comments? Okay. That was easy. I was afraid someone was going to throw me something I couldn't answer. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all learned ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Thank you, everyone. Good night.
Thank you.